I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Rudy Giuliani says Mitt Romney's was a mistake. John McCain calls Democrats socialism health care plans. What do they actually say beyond the name calling? We'll have that story. But first, President Bush is meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas separately at the White House today, ahead of tomorrow's Middle East Peace Conference in Annapolis, Maryland. The peace conference comes in the waning months of the Bush administration and follows 7 years of a hands-off attitude. Farah Stockman is foreign affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. She joins us from Washington. Farah, over the weekend, Saudi Arabian officials and Syria both said they would come with some demands that must be met if they do come to the conference. Why is it important, first of all, that these countries attend?
Their participation is key because it holds out the prospect that if Israelis make peace with Palestinians, that their neighbors will make peace with them, and that sweetens the deal for Israel quite a bit. And these countries also have a lot of influence with Palestinian leaders who could spoil the process.
Well, Saudi officials say they'll come if there are no photos of handshaking with Israeli officials. Syria said they'd come if the Golan Heights, which Israel seized during the 1967 war, are on the agenda. First of all, what does Syria want discussed?
Syria would like the return of the Golan Heights. They want to discuss the Israel-Syria peace track. Yesterday, a Syrian official told me that they believe it is on the agenda. The U.S. officials say, well, if Syria wants to bring it up, they're allowed to, but it's not specifically on the agenda.
Another issue, Hamas is not in attendance. This is the militant group that won the Palestinian elections and then attacked their partner in power sharing, Abbas, last year. Now, Hamas is cut off in the Gaza Strip with about 2 million Palestinians, Abbas and his followers holding the West Bank. How can a peace plan go forward that doesn't include Hamas?
For a lot of people, this is a big mystery. There are many respected statesmen who have urged Rice and Bush to consider reaching out in some way to Hamas, but so far the administration hasn't really budged on this issue. To them, this is a good and evil, black and white issue that either Hamas is with us or against us, and they're against us until they recognize Israel and give up violence. So we'll have to see how this goes. I think the administration is really gambling on the idea that once people in Gaza see the West Bank moving towards a better life, that they'll want a piece of that, and they will either throw out their Hamas leadership or convince them to change. That's a pretty big gamble. I don't know if we're really going to see it happen that way.
Well, what is exactly supposed to happen? You write this is not supposed to be a forum for negotiations. It's only a couple-day meeting as opposed to the week-long meetings that Presidents Clinton and Carter had. So what is the goal?
This is really a symbolic gathering. You won't see anyone with their shirt sleeves rolled up. This meeting is about the international community giving its blessing to what Olmert and Abbas want to do, which is come up with a comprehensive peace agreement by the end of Bush's term. Or if not a comprehensive peace agreement, at least the outlines of what would be a future Palestinian state and some of the steps that would have to be done to get them there.
Well, Jonathan Broder in Congressional Quarterly writes that this is actually a bold strategy to treat the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a mere loose end to be tied up on the way to forming a new alliance of Israel and Sunni Arab nations, an alliance that would unite those countries against Shia Iran.
There's a lot of people that are looking at that this way, and there's a lot of reason to believe that the reason the administration is undertaking this is because its allies in the Arab world, like Saudi Arabia, have said, you know, give us something. You guys want a lot of support on Iraq, you want a lot of support on Iran, but you have to make it more palatable to stand next to you, and it's getting harder and harder to stand next to you in the Middle East if this Palestinian issue is festering. And so I think the administration has started to realize as well that this, you know, this is a real rallying cry for extremists in the Middle East, and that solving it would help their credibility. But I don't think anybody's under any illusions that this will be easy or that it's just a loose end that will quickly be tied up. I think hearing Rice talk to reporters, I mean, she basically says, look, we're trying it, and, you know, you've got to do something. She doesn't delude herself that this is going to be easy.
Farah Stockman, foreign affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. Farah, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this past weekend, Republican presidential candidates traded insults over health care. Rudy Giuliani says the plan established by then-Governor Mitt Romney here in Massachusetts, which mandated that residents buy health care or lose a tax credit and that companies provide care or be fined, was a costly mistake, just like the failed universal health care plan of First Lady Hillary Clinton. Mitt Romney responded last night saying his plan was not Hillary care and, in fact, would insure more Americans than her current plan. Well, almost all of the top-tier presidential candidates have put forth reform plans, all of them with an eye on the rearview mirror, back to the 90s when the Clinton plan infamously failed. And our next guest said it wasn't just the Clintons. Presidents from FDR to Nixon also tried. It's just that health care reform in America is hard. Jonathan Oberlander has just written two articles on the topic for the New England Journal of Medicine. He joins us from a studio at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he's associate professor of social medicine and of health policy and administration. And Dr. Oberlander, it may be hard to reform, but it's also hard to understand the different policies. We want to go through them, but first, briefly, what was the proposal from the Clinton administration in 1993?
What they had in mind was to move the United States towards universal coverage so that all Americans would have health insurance. And the main way they were going to do that was through an employer mandate. In other words, they were going to require employers to pay about 80% of their workers' health insurance premiums. And so Americans were going to be covered by private insurance for the most part, although Medicare beneficiaries were going to keep their insurance the way it was.
Well, you say there are six lessons that can be drawn from the failure of the Clinton administration's health care reform. Let's go through those. First of all, that it's not inevitable that a reform will happen even if it's needed.
Right. You know, I think the assumption or mistaken assumption that reformers make time and again is everybody gets excited that we've declared it's a crisis and they think they're going to win because they're right, that they have morality on their side. And unfortunately, politics just doesn't work that way.
Well, also because not everyone was sure they were right. We know the huge controversy over the Clinton plan. And many Americans felt threatened. They had a plan that satisfied them.
That's right. You know, maybe the most important moral fact is that 16% of the country doesn't have health insurance. But the most important political fact is 84% of Americans do have health insurance. A lot of them like the insurance they have. And any reform that threatens to unsettle what they have is going to really erode public support.
Is it inevitable that reform means expanding government?
Yes.
Short answer.
There is no other way to do it. Maybe we wish there was, and there are different ways to expand government's role. But if we want to control costs and we want to cover more people, government has to have a bigger role.
Well, that takes us back to lessons learned. You write, money is needed to pay for reform. You also write that politics make reform difficult. The president has a limited term, the Congress very divided, and the window for reform never stays open very long.
There's a high price to failure. And if you look back at 1994 when the Clinton plan failed, what has happened in the preceding 13 years is the system has gotten much worse. We have higher health care costs, more uninsured, more businesses dropping coverage, but we've done nothing about it. When something that high profile fails, the problem is people in Congress and those who are in the White House don't want to touch it again. It's too hot. And so they've just stayed away from it for over a decade now.
Well, let's go through some of the Democratic plans. John Edwards, he put out the first plan.
Yeah, he has a very comprehensive plan. It's what's called a play or pay employer mandate. And what that means is employers have a choice in his plan. Either they have to provide health insurance coverage to their workers, or they pay a tax that goes into a government fund that then helps subsidize those workers' purchase of health insurance. And it is a universal plan. Two other elements that are important in his plan. One is that there's an individual mandate, which means that all Americans, like in Massachusetts, would be required to buy health insurance. And the second is that he creates a new public program, sort of like a Medicare option, that would compete alongside the private plans.
And how does the plan get paid for? Because you mentioned here in Massachusetts, we do have a mandate. There was a deadline which just passed of the time when people could sign up for this mandated insurance. And the most recent headline from here in Massachusetts is it was so successful, so many people signed up, that there's concern that the pool of funds that was going to pay for this or help pay for it is not enough.
a large part of his financing and the financing for other Democratic candidates comes from canceling the Bush administration tax cuts of 2001 for upper-income Americans, those making over $200,000 a year. You get a fair amount of money from doing that in the short run. In the long run, you're definitely going to need more funding sources, and neither John Edwards nor any of the other candidates has really said where that money's going to come from.
Because who wants to say the dreaded tax word?
Not when you're running for president.
No. Well, how about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? How are their plans the same or different compared to Edwards?
I'm not sure either one of them would like my answer, but their plans are virtually identical and
really?
To each other. And they're virtually identical to John Edwards. Really, they're all, again, this player pay employer mandate where employers either have to provide coverage or pay a tax, where people have a choice of keeping their existing insurance or joining a new public insurance plan. The one sort of meaningful difference between all the plans is that Hillary Clinton and John Edwards both have an individual mandate that all Americans have to buy insurance. Barack Obama only has it for children. He doesn't have it for adults. And there's been a lot of acrimony over that. But the fact is, neither John Edwards nor Hillary Clinton have said how they would enforce their individual mandate. One other thing that they do, and that is they exempt small businesses from the employer mandate.
What are some other elements in plans from Democrats?
I think, you know, one way to think about the American healthcare system, it's a series of really badly fitting building blocks. And you've got all these blocks, Medicare for the elderly, Medicaid and the state children's health insurance program for low-income Americans, and employer-sponsored insurance. And what they do in the Democratic plans is rather than erase that and create a new system, they just try and build on what we already have. So one thing all the Democrats want to do is expand Medicaid and expand the state children's health insurance program to take in more low-income Americans.
Well, we talk about mandated insurance. What about managed care, either through health systems that try to cut costs by limiting what kinds of doctors or specialists a patient can see, or through government regulation that, for instance, would stop companies from cherry-picking the healthiest patients to cut their own costs?
Well, I think there are two different questions. One is, to what extent do they want to move the system towards managed care, HMOs, and so forth, which the Clintons wanted to do in 1993? And the answer is not at all. However, what all the plans do require is a new system of regulation of private insurance. And I think there probably hasn't been enough attention to this. But essentially what they're saying is we're going to change the way that private insurance business is conducted in the United States. And they're going to have to accept everybody, regardless of how sick they are. And they're going to have to use community rating, which means they're going to have to charge the same rates, regardless if you have a pre-existing condition. And all of those things, I think, are necessary elements to make universal coverage work. The way American health policy works right now, the sicker you are, the harder it is to get health insurance on the individual market. And a fair number of Americans are just priced out of that market because they've had cancer or some other pre-existing condition. What would happen under one of these universal systems is insurance companies would not be able to do that.
Professor Jonathan Oberlander of the University of North Carolina, he mentioned politics. Well, Democrat Joe Biden is calling for government to pick up catastrophic costs, but he's against mandates. He says he doesn't want to be attacked by the right wing. Well, when we come back, the Republican plans. And later, novelist Nick Hornby, Here and Now. We're talking today about health care reform with Professor Jonathan Oberlander of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Dr. Oberlander, you distill the Democrats' narrative as Americans are going to have a choice, be able to keep their insurance if they like it. We're not here to change the system. We're going to build on it. But you're also right. The Republicans don't have the same incentive to define their plans for reform because their base has different priorities, such as immigration. But some Republican candidates have recently been speaking very heatedly about this. So let's go through some of their plans. Rudy Giuliani, when he was mayor of New York, was generally seen as favoring the expansion of social services. What has he said about this?
He has essentially said that he's going to use the tax system to try and improve insurance coverage. And what he would do is create a new tax deduction for buying health insurance. And that would be available to people regardless of whether they got insurance from their employer or not. And so it would really encourage people to move into the individual insurance market.
And former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, while governor, he passed the comprehensive health care plan here that is the mandated insurance we've been talking about.
Yeah, he's the most interesting one to me because, in a sense, the Democratic plans look a lot like Massachusetts, just on a national scale and with a bigger employer role. What he's doing as a presidential candidate is being strategically vague, I think. And he is not proposing at all what he signed on to as governor. Instead, what he has said is, as president, he would work with the states and try and craft a federalist strategy. In other words, the federal government working with the states to come up with solutions for each individual state. So it's, in a sense, less ambitious than what he signed on to as governor.
Well, and some are asking, can other states even afford the Massachusetts plan? The mandated insurance here is partly subsidized by a huge fund of money that Massachusetts has.
It's difficult for many states to duplicate what they did in Massachusetts, but I think more important than the funding is the principles. And I think he has, in a sense, run away from some of those principles. And the reason is he's running for president in Republican primaries in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, and that's a long way away from Massachusetts.
Senator John McCain of Arizona, he's sort of in somewhat the same category as favoring some expansion of insurance coverage and changes in tax policy. Tell us more about what he said about coverage.
Senator McCain has maybe the most filled in of the Republican plans, and what he has talked about is actually transforming tax policy around health insurance. Right now, when employers pay for health insurance, the money that they pay is tax exempt. He would end that tax exclusion, and in its place, he would put in this tax credit, which I think is around $2,500 for individuals and $5,000 in that range for families. And like Giuliani, he would encourage people to move away from employer-sponsored insurance and into the individual market. But he also, in his speeches, has really emphasized cost control. And what he has said is, look, expanding access to insurance is important, but we have to control costs first.
Where would John McCain get the money to give tax breaks to people who signed up?
He hasn't said. And, you know, one of the important things of running for president is to promise benefits without saying how you're going to pay for them, which is not owned by the Democratic or Republican parties. They both do it.
And by the way, as we stay with Republicans, overall, the Republican plans call for a deregulation of insurance markets. Is it fair to say that's in contrast with the Democrats who are calling for more regulation?
Absolutely. The Democrats are all about mandates, both at the employer level and the individual level, regulating and really circumscribing what private insurers can do. The Republican plans in general don't have any mandates. They don't have any expansion of a big government program. And as you said correctly, they really want to deregulate private insurance and give private insurers actually more freedom to operate.
Also, they seem to be pushing more the expansion of these health savings accounts. What are they?
Health savings accounts work a little bit like IRAs. You get catastrophic health insurance policy that has a deductible that's much higher than traditional insurance. Then you can set up a health savings account, and you put money away in that health savings account that, again, is not subject to taxes, and actually you can invest that money just like retirement money. You use the money, theoretically, in your health savings account to pay for your medical care until you hit that deductible and reach the level where you would get catastrophic health insurance. And the idea is that if you expose people to higher deductibles, that they'll make smarter choices about their medical care. The reality may be something else, but that's the theory.
Well, and tell us, what in your opinion are the riskiest things about the Republican plans, and what are the riskiest about the Democrats?
I think the riskiest aspect of the Republican plans, politically at least, is not doing enough. We have 47 million uninsured Americans. There is a tremendous public constituency at the moment for health care reform. This is an issue for businesses. This is an issue for middle-class Americans. And the question is, are they offering something that most Americans are going to consider sufficient? The flip side of the coin, the political risk for the Democrats, are people going to buy their comprehensive plans? Are they going to buy universal coverage? Are they willing to accept the idea of tax increases for universal coverage and a greater government role? That's something that we have fought about in this country for a century. And each one of those fights has been unsuccessful until now.
Well, you say until now. Do you think that there's going to be successful reform?
If I had to bet money on it, I would bet against it. But to put it in baseball terms, when the Red Sox were down 3-0 to the Yankees 4 years ago, until they came back and beat the Yankees in the playoffs, no team had ever come back and done it. So what I would say about health reform is the same. It's improbable But just because it hasn't happened before doesn't mean it's impossible.
And what do you think of all the plans and all the talk is the most urgent thing that's missing?
Cost control. The irony of American health politics is rising costs put health reform on the agenda, but virtually none of the plans seriously control costs because politically that's very difficult to do. It means you take on insurers and the drug industry and hospitals and doctors and the entire status quo. You know, I think the other thing is we've had 100 years of sort of propagandizing against socialized medicine in this country. And it would probably come as a surprise to many Americans that people in Canada and people in these European countries live longer. In many cases, they actually average more physician visits a year and more hospital days a year than we do. You know, there's not healthcare reform for free. I wish it was free. And so we've got to find a way to pay for this. And I think the one of the issues coming into the 2008 elections is going to be, what are we going to do?
Dr. Jonathan Oberlander, Associate Professor of Social Medicine and Health Policy and Administration at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Oberlander, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, is glass ceiling a phrase that's actually held women back? That's tomorrow. Still to come, Senator Trent Lott resigns. That's ahead, Here and Now. It's going to cost a lot more to heat your home this winter. According to the Energy Information Administration, the average American household will pay $986 for heating. That's up almost 11% from a year ago. And for those who just use home heating oil, the costs are expected to rise over 25% from last year. So it's time for those seasonal primers on lowering energy costs. Jennifer Amon is co-author of the 9th edition of The Consumer's Guide to Home Energy Savings. She joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Jennifer, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
And it has to be updated every year because we learn so much every year about energy costs. And by the way, we're aware of our listeners in the Southwest where it's, you know, their concern is, you know, keeping cool in the heat. So we'll address that as well. But right at the beginning, you have a checklist for action homeowners can take. Let's start with the list to do today. A lot we've already heard of, but I love this note. If you have a silent guzzler, a waterbed, make your bed.
That's right. Fewer and fewer homes, I think, still have water beds, but there are more out there than you might think. And just simply putting the covers up, you know, following your mom's advice and making your bed will really save up to a third of the energy that you're using in that water bed. Otherwise, it's just leaking out into the room.
Okay. And the rest of the things, turn down the settings on your water heater, use energy saving settings on your appliances, clean air filters on your air conditioner, furnace, and heat pump. Is this something you should get a professional in for?
No, in most homes, the furnace and air conditioner use the same filter. So it's just a matter of going down, finding out where that is. It might be in your basement right there with the furnace, or in some cases it might be in a utility closet somewhere in your home, and just making that swap. And we recommend that you do that once a month during the heating and cooling season. And a nice way to remember is maybe do it when you pay your mortgage each month, or if you have another bill or activity that you do once a month, start tying that filter change to that activity.
And how much really does that help?
On the order of a few percent, maybe as much as 5% or more, depending on the dust in your home. Really, basically what you're doing is you're letting your fan work as efficiently as possible. The more clogged your filter, the harder it has to work to push air across the filter and through your home.
So those are things you can do right now, things you can do over the course of a week, buy low-flow shower heads. We all know about getting compact fluorescent light bulbs. We've covered that. But buy a blanket for your water heater. You know, water heaters are, you know, things that some people are hesitant to go near. There's sort of a fear factor.
Right.
How do you know? I mean, there's different kinds of water heaters. How do you know how to do that?
Yeah, the water heater blanket is really best suited if you have an electric water heater and one that's more than maybe 7 or 8 years old. A new one, you may benefit a little bit, but you'll definitely benefit more with an older unit. And, you know, it sounds complicated, but trust me, this is something anyone can do. You can pick up one of these for less than $10 at the hardware store. All you need is a little tape. You wrap it up, tape it in place. It can be done lickety-split.
You say things to do this month, seal up the air leaks. This is where everybody runs around with a little caulking thing. But you point out, yes, we know about leaky windows, but don't forget where the pipes go in and out of a building.
That's right. Any place where you may have an opening on an exterior wall, so that could be plumbing penetrations. Even your electrical outlets might be a place where you feel a draft in your home. And there are specially made products available at any home store, and they really highlight these products this time of year, so you shouldn't have any problem finding them.
You say people should hire an energy auditor. Now, they will look for the leaks in your house, but we understand, I mean, these aren't just people who come in and stand in the middle of the room and say, oh, yeah, chilly in here. You're talking about people who have some real tools. Talk about these tools.
There are still some people offering just basic energy audits, letting you know what the equipment is, but you can also get a much more sophisticated energy performance audit, and they'll use things like a blower door where they actually put this in place of your front door. They seal up your home, pressurize it, and find out where all the leaks are, so they're really able to target their efforts. They'll use a digital infrared camera to see where your insulation levels may be lacking, and they can also do what's called a duct blaster test, where they actually seal off your ducts and find out where the leaks are there.
Okay. Things that people should do over the course of a year. Insulation, we always hear that. But replace aging appliances. You say even if an appliance seems to have a few good years on it, you should replace it. Is there that much savings?
Yeah, if your refrigerator, for instance, is approaching 10 years old, there's a good chance that you could save at least 30% on its energy consumption if you upgrade to a high-efficiency new model. Similarly, with clothes washers and dishwashers, new models on the market are big energy savers and also water savers, and that's a real important issue in many parts of the country.
Talk for a second about a part of the country that's seeing extreme heat in the Southwest, because you talk about, and this applies to all areas of the country, but windows.
Right. What you want to do when you look at new windows is you want to make sure you're getting those that are optimized for your climate. So if you're in a colder part of the country, you really want windows that have a great insulating ability. You want windows that keep the air you've heated in your house and keep the cold air out. You're not as worried about sunlight coming in and heating the home. And in fact, in the winter, you may try to capture as much sunlight during the day as you can. In the Southwest, you're in the opposite position. You're not as worried about insulating against cold winter drafts, but you really want to keep out as much of that solar heat as you can. And there are special coatings on windows, many which nowadays are completely invisible to the human eye, that can really filter out that solar radiation.
Okay. Will, your book takes on big issues like whether to choose a ground source heat pump or an air heat pump, kind of complicated issues, and you go into detail. But if we can just do a lightning round through some of these little known facts that you also present. Ice makers and door ice and water dispensers increase energy consumption how much?
Ice makers and through-the-door water dispensers can increase energy consumption by 10 to 20% in your refrigerator.
Wow. Give us some more of these little reminders that add up.
A clothes dryer is now one of the largest energy users in your home. So by replacing your clothes washer with a unit that gets more water out, you can save time and energy in your dryer.
You also write, setting your thermostat back 10 degrees for 8 hours at night can save $70 per $1,000 heating cost. Match a pan to the burner on a stovetop. Now, how significant could that be?
Well, you know, that's one of those things that's just a little percentage of your cooking costs. But if you're heating up your pans every night, cooking dinner, it can really start to add up.
If you put the 6-inch pan on the 8-inch burner, you're losing energy.
That's right.
And finally, set the record straight on power supplies. These are those external power packs that charge our cell phones and our cameras. President Bush was sort of made fun of because he tried to say something about how they were wasting energy. But they are wasting energy if you leave them plugged in.
That's right. And one real test is when you touch these items and they're plugged in, they're usually hot. And that's just a sign of wasted energy. Energy wasted is heat. And so if you have a device that you've taken off the charger, unplug the charger just to be safe. If you have other items you're not using, unplug them and you'll see your savings really add up.
You have a statistic on these power packs. And this is when they are not plugged to a device. They're just plugged into a wall.
There are about 2.5 billion power supplies in use here in the U.S. That's about 2% of the country's electricity production and almost 50 million tons of carbon dioxide
emitted every year. So unplug them.
That's right.
Jennifer Amon, co-author of the 9th edition of the Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings. Jennifer, if you had one thing that you could say to people that would help cut their energy bill and they would just go home and do it today, what would it be?
The easiest thing to do today would be to swap out your incandescents with compact fluorescent lamps.
Just flat out do it.
That's right.
Jennifer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, another thing you can do today, check out our website for more information on cutting heating costs. That's here-now.org. And remember, you can download a podcast of today's program a little later today. Again, that's at here-now.org. In about 6 minutes, High Fidelity author Nick Hornby's new novel, once again about a boy about to become a dad. You're listening to Here and Now. Trent Lott of Mississippi, the Senate's number two Republican, is stepping down and will leave the Senate before the end of the year. He made the announcement today in Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Let me make it clear. There are no problems. I feel fine. I may look my 66 years, but I honestly feel good. And I get up every day believing that I can maybe have a positive effect on what we do in the Senate. I like being a happy warrior. I don't like some of the negativism that we're dealing with now, but that's life, and that's the role, I guess, of politics sometimes.
Joining us, Rick Klein, who writes the political blog The Note for ABC News. Rick, as we just heard, Lott says he's in good health. He said he's leaving to do something else. What is that?
Well, he's leaving on his own terms is one piece of it. He did decide to run for re-election last year, despite a lot of predictions that he wouldn't. But leaving on his own terms means probably going out and making some money. He was asked at the press conference whether he'd become the chancellor at Ole Miss. I think that's a possibility. I also think that it's a distinct possibility that he'll get into the lobbying game and that sometime after the new administration takes office in January 2009, a new Congress comes into town, someone's going to want the services of a former majority leader who certainly knows a lot of folks in Washington and knows how to count the votes.
And by law, he has to sit out a year before he can do lobbying.
That's right. The timeline works out well for him. If he deciding to leave before the end of 2007 means he'd have to sit out 2008 as a lobbyist. Now, there's other things he can do in that time as a consultant, as a lawyer affiliated with lobbying firms, but he wouldn't be able to lobby Congress directly. That changes in January of 2009. He'd be a very attractive commodity to a lot of firms out there who will be in a hiring mood. Like they are every 4 years, when there's a change of administration, there's a lot of turnover, and when there's a new Congress coming to town, a lot of folks want to know someone they know who has the biggest Rolodex in town.
Well, to remind ourselves, in 2002, Trent Lott saluted retiring Senator Strom Thurmond with comments that many people thought were support for the old Southern segregationist policies. He apologized, but President Bush distanced himself. Lott had to step down as the party Senate leader. And he's also, you know, said that he blamed President Bush for the devastation along the Mississippi Gulf Coast caused by Hurricane Katrina and the lack of, you know, follow-up for that. So I'm wondering if he's disillusioned with his party.
I think there's a piece of that, but I think he's not been close to the Bush White House after they engineered to put Bill Frist in power as majority leader over him. After the series of events that you referenced, the 100th birthday party for Strom Thurmond, he's disillusioned with the Bush administration, but they're on the way out. I think more broadly, though, he doesn't like being in the minority, and he, like some other veterans of Congress, like the former House Speaker Dennis Hastert, among others, they're looking at the prospect of an extended period of time where Republicans are likely to be in the minority in Congress. The map is very bad for Republicans in the Senate in 2008. They're probably going to lose more seats. And Trent Lott would rather count votes for the winning side than count votes basically for obstructionism, which is essentially what the minority in the Senate can do is to block what the majority is doing.
Yeah. And Lott is the sixth Senate Republican this year to announce retirement. Well, we know that Mississippi's Republican Governor Haley Barbour will appoint Lott's replacement, who will serve until the 2008 elections. But what names are floating up for who might take it from there?
Well, it'll be a wide open seat, and you know you'll
wide open or among Republicans.
Wide open among the Republicans, mm-hmm. Primarily. It almost certainly is going to remain in Republican hands. Although you never know when these seats only come open every once a generation or two sometimes. So a lot will depend on the decision that Governor Barbour makes, and he hasn't tipped his hand yet. Exactly who he's thinking about, but there's a number of attractive possibilities of veterans of Republican politics in Mississippi. But when these open seats happen, it makes the Republican Party play defense in a state where they'd rather not, and they will have to invest some resources in Mississippi, a state obviously wasn't on their map at all. Tad Cochran, the senior senator from Mississippi, has decided to seek re-election, so the Democrats weren't looking at good prospects in the state of Mississippi. That could change. There'll be a tension there. It's probably going to remain a Republican seat, so it won't have national implications, beyond the fact that one of the consummate deal-makers is leaving the Senate.
Rick Klein writes the political blog The Note for ABC News, commenting on the fact that Trent Lott of Mississippi has announced that he will retire before the end of the year. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Okay. In 1 minute, author Nick Hornby, here and now. Let's run through novelist Nick Hornby's titles. There was Fever Pitch, Men Obsessed with Soccer. High Fidelity, Men Obsessed with Records. About a Boy, Men Obsessed with Women. In his new book, the writer whose characters sometimes behave like obsessive teenagers is a teenager. And 16-year-old Sam is obsessed with skateboarding, then a girl, then with thoughts that that girl may be pregnant by him. And the only one Sam can talk to is real-life skateboard champion Tony Hawk on a poster on his wall.
Does this sound mad to you? It probably does, but I don't care, really. Who doesn't talk to someone in their heads? Who doesn't talk to God or a pet or someone they love who's died, or maybe just to themselves? Tony Hawk, he wasn't me, but he was who I wanted to be, so that makes him the best version of myself, and that can't be a bad thing, to have the best version of yourself standing there on a bedroom wall and watching you. Anyway, all I'm saying is that there was this time, maybe it was a day, maybe a few days, I can't remember now, when everything seemed to have come together. And so obviously it was time to go and screw it all up.
Author Nick Hornby reading from his new book, Slam, and he joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, Sam talks directly to us, the readers. It's a spot-on voice of a kid, poignant, sometimes hilarious, you know, trying to make his way through this fog he's in of adolescence. Also an alarming lack of awareness of, you know, the real world around him. Where did you get this voice?
Well, starting with me, I guess, when I was that age, and imagining the panic that I would have felt if a girlfriend at the time had got pregnant. And I think that the moment you start to make a character do something that you've never done, he becomes his own person and you're off and running.
Tell us more about Sam. He's one of those kids, like you see them there, 15, 16, just stunned by life.
He's a reasonably bright working class kid. Who falls hard for this middle-class girl. His mum had him when she was 16, and so he's always been terrified of making somebody pregnant, but of course that doesn't necessarily stop him having sex with somebody. Mm-hmm. He has ambitions to go to college, and he feels things pretty deeply.
Let's pick up on one of those thoughts. The son of a woman who also had a child at 16.
Yeah, well, I think Sam's always felt that his mum kind of blames him because, of course, the more you say, don't do what I did, the more you feel that you yourself were a mistake. And I think that that's difficult for a kid to take on.
And let's be clear here. You know, he's a loved kid, too.
Yeah, he's a loved kid. Yeah. His parents haven't been able to make the relationship work, as parents of that age usually can't.
So now he's got this, it is true, she is pregnant, even though he barely knew how to perform the act. The way he describes his thoughts to us, in his world, a baby is, even without a machine gun, like a terrorist, every bit as deadly to his chances for getting into college. He really wants to get out of the world that he's in. You know, very funny, but not.
I didn't want to make this an issue book. I didn't want to be preachy. I mean, if a kid read this book and decided that having a kid when you're 16 is not the best idea in the world, I'd be happy if they took that away. But that really wasn't the intention. The intention was to say, well, this has happened to these people. Let's talk about what that must feel like to them.
There's also this phantasmagorical catapulting of Sam into the future. At first, I thought they were dreams.
Absolutely not dreams.
What are
it
they?
It actually happened.
He went into the future.
He went into the future.
And he sees himself as a father. He meets his child.
He is himself. I mean, he's occupying his own body, but he doesn't have the skills that he's clearly developed in this time, if you see what I mean. So, first of all, I thought that was just a funny idea, that you wake up and you're doing something that you apparently don't know how to do. So,
like changing a baby.
Like changing a baby. I mean, Sam's kind of jumped a year of his life, and he's suddenly expected to perform these apparently impossible tasks. There are three of these little flash forwards.
He whizzes into the future.
He's been whizzed.
Whizzed.
He's been whizzed, and he thinks it's Tony Hawk who's somehow whizzed him.
The skateboarder.
For a parent of any age, I think what it looks like from the outside is that everything is a pain. That, you know, a baby stops you doing things and stops you sleeping and you're covered in disgusting things most of the time. But, of course, what it feels like on the inside is very different. And Sam has to kind of learn that as he goes along.
A lot of reading the book, feels like you're inside a video game. You're whizzing around.
I guess that's the one aspect of this book that maybe I wouldn't have done in an adult novel, only because my nerve would have failed me with the adult novel. But I think that kids, because of the kinds of movies they watch and the kinds of games they play, would be maybe better attuned to this kind of narrative. Of course, the other thing about teenagers is that you're kind of occupying the now and tomorrow all at the same time. And in fact, I've been reading this book to teens, especially in the UK. And of course, I'm thinking all the time, well, have I got this right? Have I got this right? And then you look at the faces of the kids in the audience, and that the faces are so young, and these kids, you know, there are boys not shaving and they're 16. And I know that we have the highest teen pregnancy rates in Europe. So, of course, it must be right that these thoughts are extremely confused, and yet these kids, some of them will become fathers very soon.
Who do you think Sam is going to grow up to be? Because so many of the male characters, the beloved characters in your other books, have been these sort of like lost boys. Is Sam going to be one of them, or do you think this experience changes that, or what do you think?
I think that Sam is more driven, actually, than any of those characters. So I suspect that he's going to achieve what he wants to achieve, but much, much slower than he wanted to.
Tell us more about Sam's relationship with Tony Hawk, real-life skateboarder who was a superstar at like 12 and just a huge star. What's that about, that connection?
Originally, Tony Hawk was going to be a soccer player, but in fact, soccer seemed a little bit too ubiquitous in the UK, and not as cool as it used to be. I mean, it's been very kind of Nike-ized. So,
and what's his name? Moved to Los Angeles.
Beckham. Yeah. Right. And then when I read Tony Hawk's autobiography as research for the book, he's written so frankly about his own relationships and his own sexual experience, early sexual experience, and becoming a father. And I thought, oh, well, this is perfect. So, you know, what happens in the book is that Sam talks to Tony Hawk and Tony Hawk talks back, but
yes,
only in lines from his own autobiography.
Right.
So he's kind of limited in what he can say. But what it does is turn the autobiography into like the I Ching, I guess. There are these gnomic utterances that Sam needs to puzzle out, and he can always make them make sense in the end.
Or not. There's a certain point where he says, oh, God, what am I listening to you for?
but in fact, when he says that, that's when Tony Hawk whizzes him. Well, that's what he thinks. So it turns out to be Sam being dense rather than Tony Hawk being unhelpful.
Right. And Sam, the character that you have written about in the book Slam. By the way, Slam, it's a skateboarding term for when you get slammed. And
a bad fall, yeah.
And I would imagine the fall he takes in life, too.
Yeah.
Do you see him on the screen?
Well,
I do, when I was reading it. I mean, I could see it.
And it's interesting because I think some of the technique of the novel is borrowed from cinema. Those flash forwards are cinematic, not in the sense that I was hoping someone would buy it for the screen, but it's a device that I've enjoyed in films, and so I borrowed. So, yeah, I don't mind flogging it back to them. A few people have asked, and I guess something will happen.
Yeah. But read it in book form. Nick Hornby's new book is Slam. For more on the book, go to our website, here-now.org. Nick Hornby, thank you so much.
Pleasure, thank you. 'Cause I'm a one-man guy.